welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and each week on Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between our personal health and well-being and the health of everything in our total health environment, our total world. On this show, we cover different facets of the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the future ecological stability or lack thereof of our planet, the health of our communities, the health of our society, to personal and collective well-being. Each week on the show, I welcome different authors, advocates, activists, filmmakers, thought leaders, scientists, you know, and poets even, all kinds of different people to discuss the different aspects of all the different things to which we are connected and interconnected and interwoven that are impacting our vibrancy, our life, our well-being on, you know, individual and collective levels. On today's show, I'm really thrilled to welcome a guest who's someone that I've admired for quite some time and followed his work, and he's come out with a new book, which is really a fantastic it's a fantastic book, and it was a great thing to undertake. I'm so glad that he did it. I'm really high on this particular book. My guest today is Daniel Pinchbeck. He is the best-selling author of Breaking Open the Head and 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And, in fact, there was a film based on that, and I think that's where I first personally began encountering him and going to some of his events. And I believe I even challenged his panel about fracking activism at the premiere of that in New York City, and have followed his work ever since. And it's really interesting how in over time, you know, or maybe he's changed, maybe I've changed, maybe we both changed. I hope everyone is changing and transforming in a good way, to the point where I just feel really close to what he's done in his new book, How Soon Is Now. Daniel Pinchbeck is also a co-founder of the web magazine Reality Sandwich and the online platform Evolvere.net. His essays and articles have appeared in publications including the New York Times, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and Art Forum. What a diverse group. Daniel is a writer, but he's also, I would call him also a very important thought leader because, you know, Daniel, you are asking the key questions that need to be asked. And, you know, first let's begin with How Soon Is Now? It has an introduction by Russell Brand and a preface by Sting showing, you know, your ability to kind of take tough, systemic, collective issues and deal with them, present them in a way that people can relate to, that's highly personal, that's real, you know, so that it's while giving, you know, I find this book extraordinary because you really set up our contemporary problem, the huge problem facing us, but in ways that are, in a way that's extremely accessible, and I love the subtitle too, From Personal Initiation to Global Transformation. Tell me, How Soon Is Now? The title of the book is, you know, I think some people will kind of instantly get it. I think it's a brilliant title. What was it, you know, just to, how did you come to the title and what did you have in mind in calling the book that? What were you seeking to do in titling it that way?
Well, the title has nothing to do with the song by the Smiths. When I was writing my last book, 2012, I was often writing in a cafe on 6th Street, I think. And there was a truck passed outside that had How Soon Is Now spray painted on it. So the phrase kind of stuck in my mind. And I mean, the question about, you know, time, cycles of time has been a part of my work. But here it's also kind of referring to the kind of like in the chapter of the book about kind of revolution. I have a quote from Herbert Marcuse, who believes that humans have, like, modern humans have this guilt, underlying kind of guilt and shame because of a deed that we have not accomplished, which is the deed of liberation, which is kind of like freeing ourselves from these like destructive parasitic systems and so on. And so, yeah, so, you know, like, and so we, it's like almost like a delay or something that holds us back. And I feel like the now would be when we break through and realize that, you know, we have to address this stuff, you know, right now, rather than putting it off, you know.
Right, we've deferred it. We regard, you know, the environmental collapse that, you know, is kind of lurking in our not too distant future if we continue on our current course as something, you know, that we were hoping was further down line. And, you know, and there's always a tendency to defer addressing these larger issues as they become, you know, these systemic imbalances and problems that we have created for ourselves as they become more and more chaotic and destructive. And, you know, so to me, the book is, you know, the title is basically saying the time is now, you know, like
right.
we can't defer any longer. It's funny because somebody on some site I just read the other day posted something and said most of the failure that people experience is in pulling back the horse as it is leaping forward. In other words, going with the leap rather than, you know, doing the measured thing and kind of containing the impulse of a leaping horse is what is going to kind of is going to be a more successful approach to getting us through this time. And this, I think that's a statement for both personal transformation and also collective transformation, because we kind of really have to do something. I think you analyze it in the book, and we really don't know what to do. What I love about How Soon Is Now is that you really delve fully into the problem. For example, when we look at, you know, the climate change problem, one of the things that, you know, kind of when, you know, I think the Native Americans with the Dakota Access Pipeline have shown us, you know, how to take action right now when something is on your doorstep and imminently threatening. And even though we all are in those kinds of circumstances, you know, or in that circumstance on a broader level, we kind of don't really realize it, and we don't know what to do about it because of the complexity of the structures of our society that are all kind of working together to hold in place this kind of destructive system. And along with that, we ourselves. And what I love about this book is your way of really getting into what's both collective and what's personal in all of that. You know, through your own trips and travels and the opportunities that you've had as a writer to kind of experience different things from Burning Man, which, you know, opens, you know, the beginning of the book, onto a whole host of other encounters with shamans and just access to people doing advanced technological and innovative things. There's a tremendous breadth there. The one thing that I really came away with very strongly is a sense that you share, that you have, that the infrastructures which are so entrenched and seem so hard to kind of change or unravel are actually creations that we're all participating in that can be changed. I think that's the strongest message of the book. At least that's what I really took away from it. How do you see that? Because most people look at this and they're like, oh my God, you know, we have to do something incremental. We'll never get XYZ horrible group that's doing some destructive, inhumane thing to ever alter. Why aren't they thinking about their grandchildren? Where you kind of see a lot more mutability and choice sort of through these systems than I think most people that write about this have identified. How did you come to that, and what is it, you know, how do you happen to see that, and what is it that you see in that regard?
I think that's the longest question I've ever been asked.
Everyone's always telling me that about my darn questions. Yeah. Yeah, I hear it a lot.
There are so many pieces to it that I'm not even sure. Hold on a second. I mean, we're definitely in a very you know, severe circumstance. You know, what I point out in the book and what I believe is that, you know, under Clinton and Obama, you know, we weren't addressing the level of the ecological crisis. You know, and one thing I really try to do in the book is make people aware that, you know, climate change is just one aspect. I mean, you know, that feel that kind of like hits kind of like a dead zone in people's brains at this point. And there's also still so much distraction around it. But you know, there's a whole model called the Planetary Boundaries Model from the Stockholm Resilience Center. And they look at, you know, the main drivers being like biodiversity loss, you know, climate change. They look at 9 different boundaries. They see that we've trespassed maybe 3 of them, and we're on the verge of trespassing another 3, and each one, you know, is endangering for us. There's, you know, ocean acidification is one of them. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. You know, we're losing 150 to 200 species a day out of 8.2 million species totally on the planet. So that's something like 10% loss of the remaining biodiversity every 10 to 15 years. And yeah, and if you go back to the WikiLeaks, emails, for instance, I mean, Hillary Clinton was very proud of her support of fracking. She was telling her Wall Street masters that, that was a great thing that she was fracking, they were fracking now. So we need something, we needed much deeper systemic change to prevent biospheric collapse. So in that sense, as horrible and as dangerous as this Trump situation is, we have to hope, and even though it doesn't necessarily seem like it's going that direction right now, that it leads to a much deeper waking up. And the types of solutions that we're going to need to deal with this situation, as you said, are not incremental. They're going to have to be more like scalable and exponential. So like a new template for community forums, for resistance, and that suddenly becomes, you know, moves like wildfire, you know, through the society. You know, in the same way we saw the sort of viral contagion of like the Arab Spring revolution in 2011, I do argue that as entrenched as these systems do seem, there are opportunities sometimes to change them or to flip them, or they break down, or people suddenly disinvest from them. So the Berlin Wall, 1999, was an example. Like, you know, no think tank. No journalists had been saying up to that point that people were just going to rise up and take the wall down by hand, and it wouldn't lead to wars or nuclear wars or whatever. So that just happened because people couldn't have a wall like that anymore. They didn't believe in it. You know, the trust in that idea had faded out. And I think, you know, with what's happening now, the already shaky trust in things like the banking system and the government, you know, is going to be so eroded that potentially it could allow for a whole other approach to how we exchange value, to how we form power and communities and so on.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, every 5 minutes or every, you know, half hour, there's a new, news item about what the current administration is doing. And, of course, you know, everybody's like, let's resist. We must resist. And, you know, but it becomes and then what is the next step? We're supposed to write our elected officials, as you've just detailed in your reflections on the so-called good guy Democrats and their failure of action on these important fronts. The elected officials we're hoping to call on both sides of the aisle are entrenched with Wall Street and the banks and the donors, and they're not really responsive to the cries of the people. So, you know, we're kind of marking this as seeing that, you know, each one that happens, it's like, call these officials who will be unresponsive.
One of the reasons that I felt it was very important to do this book, and it was, whatever reason, mm-hmm. very, very difficult for me to do this book. It took like 10 years of failure, basically, like trying and failing, was I felt that there wasn't really that the progressive community or the cultural creatives or the left, whatever you want to call them, don't really have a coherent idea of what we want as an alternative.
Yes.
You know, the right wing, down the extreme right, you know, is very clear. You know, they want, you know, oligarchy, privatized control. You know, they want to limit social services. You know, they want lower taxes for the wealthy and so on. You know, basically oligarchy. But I think the alternative needs to be as coherently expressed and mapped out so people can actually rally around something. And so that was one of the reasons why I felt it was really important to do a book like this. And in the
book, totally agree with you. Yeah,
I look at the technical infrastructure, kind of technical system aspects of what we would have to change. And then I look at the social and political aspects, the economic system. And then I also talk about kind of the third area being kind of like consciousness, how that's shaped through culture, through media, through social technologies, and so on. And yeah, it's like we need to understand how these three areas would have to change kind of in tandem to avert, you know, the likelihood of, you know, it could, almost could actually be an extinction crisis for our species.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that is, that's the concern that would concern most of us, as well as, you know, there's many other extinctions that are going on at all times, as you detailed just now. I mean, one of the things, just to take one piece of this, one of the things that, you know, I see as someone from the progressive side and, you know, kind of arrived through the last year at the understanding of how limited our hands on democracy actually are, you know, is all of these things that are going on as the right wing leads really lay bare for all to see the incredible extinction process built into capitalism itself when carried unfettered to its end stage. So even though I'm, you know, obviously not thrilled this is happening, and I don't know anyone who is really, in terms of all of the destructions and the way that the government is being set up just for corporate profit and you know, kind of life and human beings and the earth be damned kind of thing. It is having the effect, I think, of waking people up who maybe were thought themselves in good stead or who could coast along with capitalism and, you know, figured there was some way to kind of modify it. It really, we're seeing how destructive fundamentally it is, and you offered that critique in the book as well. I mean, you really analyze the core problem with it. Do you want to share some of that with our, you know, our listeners here?
Sure. I mean, the core problem, I mean, what I try to do in the book is look at things kind of, you know, from an evolutionary perspective and kind of systemically. So it's not really mm-hmm. about blaming or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, capitalism developed over, you know, the last five centuries, and before that was, you know, European, you know, dominator, patriarchy, culture, and so on, and Christianity. There was, you know, kind of, I mean, you know, according to like Rousseau, you know, it was like the origin of inequality was private property and enclosure, mm-hmm. you know, of property. You know, and now we see with the corporations kind of like this mania of, you know, privatizing, you know, everything and turning everything into a profit center. You know, I guess I look at it from a design perspective that, like, you know, corporations are these incredible social technologies that we've constructed. They're kind of like artificial life forms in themselves. And we also mm-hmm. created a game in which these life forms have to survive and thrive, which is called the stock market. So we've only given them one direction, which is to maximize financial value, to maximize shareholder value. So there was a deep flaw in our design, and that's leading to this outcome, you know, because like a corporation has to evade ecological restrictions and corrupt lobbyists and buy politicians, and, you know, it has to find the most sociopathic character types, because its only directive is to maximize shareholder value and maximize profit. So mm-hmm. ultimately, if we want to survive as a species, we have to change the game machinery, like change the logic of the game, and say that, you know, what the market allows for is kind of more like cooperative infrastructures that, you know, not only maximize profit, but also, you know, maximize health of communities, local integrity of local communities, you know, integrity of nature, natural systems, and so on. So I mean, you know, there are many different ways to look at, you know, the problem and the crisis, but I think using thinking about it through design is a very clean way.
Because it's both empowering, because if we designed it, or, you know, it was designed by humans can change the design. You know, one of the things that comes through, and I was kind of getting at this with an earlier question, that was too long, that comes through very strongly is your experience and belief in human adaptability, flexibility. You know, it's kind of by presenting a vision which you kind of describe repeatedly, which actually is, I think, very helpful in for a reader assimilating it as being utopian, seeming unlikely to happen, but kind of needs to happen so that we have a bit of a lodestar to sort of head toward. You know, you're kind of positing that we can be driven to a point where we will welcome some of the changes that the book outlines and be able to make those adaptations, which I find incredibly hopeful, really, and fantastic. One of the things I think that we saw in the last year's election with the, you know, kind of liberal, neoliberal, progressive divide and everything was that older generation people were wanting, naturally, as befits biologically their time of life, a more incremental approach that was more consonant with the past, and younger people are really more ready for change because they see their future, you know, kind of threatened. How adaptable are people at different times of life, and how adaptable do you think human beings truly are for what we're being called to in this situation?
Humans are totally adaptable and will change in a moment, given the opportunity for something better. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's pretty much, you know, or for something worse, you know. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, one of my, you know, sort of, in the book I talk about the Burning Man Festival and how you can see kind of like, you know, not that it's like a paradise or anything, but you can see like these corporate lawyers and you know, high-functioning, you know, people go there. And, you know, because the ethos of the place is, you know, leave no trace and share and, you know, based on gifts, no money exchanged, you know, they would very quickly, almost immediately go through this transformation where, they just adapt these different principles and they make them happier. So, I mean, you know, in general, I think people are quite adaptive. I mean, in the book, I also talk about Rebecca Solnit's kind of book, Paradise Built in Hell. She visited all these former disaster zones and found that, you know, they really weren't, when the disaster strikes, you know, it doesn't go into a dog-eat-dog, you know, mentality. People actually become more caring and empathic and altruistic and drop their egos. And even long after the disaster, a lot of the people she talked to remember them as like the best times of their lives. So I think that people are very adaptive. They adapt to the systems around them. Human nature is very permeable. Human nature itself is something that changes. And you know, people, everybody wants a better life, you know, so if you figure out a way to show people how to have a better life, they'll get there. And in our circumstance, I mean, you know, we have to address the reality of what's happening on the earth somehow or other. You know, so mm-hmm. for instance, we have to look at something in an area like agriculture, you know, like at the moment with our industrial farming practices, according mm-hmm. to the UN, we only have about 60 years of harvest left until the topsoil of the planet is so depleted that we can't farm anymore. But we know there are all these other practices that actually replenish or restore carbon to the soil. So there's no-till farming, permaculture, organic agriculture, biodynamic agriculture. Now, these forms of agriculture are different in that they're a lot more time-consuming and energy-consuming. People have to be trained to be more connected to the land and to be more attentive and so on. You can't just, like, you know, swab a huge area with the fertilizer and plant, you know, monoculture crops. So, you know, and also we've had an idea in our mind of what progress is. So we think that progress means everybody leaves the countryside, they come to the city, it's so much more interesting, they get colorful, exciting jobs at like factories or working for advertising agencies or whatever. So that's this kind of, you know, 20th century modern dream that we've created. And now we basically would have to create a different dream. I mean, you know, first of all, I don't think, you know, city life over time is not proving to be maybe as exhilarating as everybody thought. You know, maybe mm-hmm. people could be, you know, retrained and relocated you know, out in the countryside, you know, trained to regrow, you know, some of their food, living in more like multi-generational communities, you know, through the internet, still connected to the world, you know, still mobile in that sense. And maybe with a basic income or universal subsidy so that nobody has to be suffering, you know, unnecessarily. Which is really what thinkers like Buckminster Fuller saw back in the 60s, right? He saw that we already had the technical ability to create a world that worked for everybody, where everybody was, you know, able to pursue education if they didn't have a job, and, you know, nobody had to have anxiety just to survive. But, and, you know, we have that excess still, even with climate change at the moment. But, we would need to redirect, you know, our society and rethink our models of progress and then almost like market, you know, create a marketing and propaganda promotion campaign around it, much like advertising does with all the stuff that they promote. You know, we can look at also like one of the ways that Trump won this election was promising the white working class that he was going to bring back manufacturing, you know, that we're going to have another golden age of industry. Well, we know that that's totally bogus, that we're actually seeing much, much more automation. And in fact, we're going to be losing, you know, millions and millions of jobs to automation. So, for instance, like, you know, the biggest workforce in the U.S. is truck drivers. There's 3.5 million truck drivers here. Well, now we have self-driving vehicles. You know, there's going to be no need for those truck drivers in, you know, 3, 5, 10 years. That's over, you know. So, you know, that should actually be, you know, not a reason to be upset and call for more jobs or whatever, but it should actually be a reason to celebrate. I mean, wasn't that the whole point of mechanization and automation, was to liberate people from drudgery? You know, but instead we've created more busyness, more anxiety, you know, through artificial mechanisms of the financial system. You know, this is also like, you know, something that I look at in the book a lot. Like you look at, you know, Oscar Wilde recognized this back in the early 20th century. He talked about how, you know, what we want is automation to liberate people from drudgery, to have a kind of, you know, to some extent, a kind of socialism of some sort where, you know, people are provided with their basic needs and then they can, you know, all have the time and the opportunity to love, to cultivate their unique gifts, you know, to become artists if they want or whatever they want to do. You know, this capacity that now only a small echelon of the wealthy people have.
Well, you know, it's strange because a statistic that I've seen that when people retire, you know, they often die immediately thereafter. That is following a lifetime of not really being able to conceive of oneself or one's activities apart, you know, from this kind of structured, you know, workforce indenturement, you know. So, you know, as you describe what you're talking about, you know, it sounds immediately appealing. I mean, when this whole administration came in, I found that I, having been a news cycle reporter and somebody who's like disseminating information all the time, I really couldn't focus on it overly much. And I decided without kind of feeling despair, truly, because I think what you have to say is correct about really the, you know, it being unclear what the pathway to the right solutions are, and that's why I'm so grateful for this book for delineating them. But, you know, when that was going on, I just decided, well, I have to do something else other than be mentally involved in, you know, this horror for many hours of the day. And I was like, well, what am I going to do with myself? And I decided to take up cooking and sewing. I mean, I cooked before, but I was doing a lot more cooking, a lot more sewing, a lot more organizing. And actually, I found that I really liked it, and it was extremely creative. And, you know, if it weren't for the urgencies of our time, I could, you know, happily do that all the time. So even, you know, someone who's been a borderline workaholic for so many years like myself, I mean, I think, you know, what you describe is like a tantalizing possibility, but given the punitive attitudes that have been pervaded in our society, people, you know, that would be like shirking, I'm not entitled to that, what about, you know, people are fighting with their neighbor or fighting with recent immigrants because they are desperately, you know, clutched by the, you know, and kind of descending into hatred, really, because they feel someone is taking something away from them. The idea that there could be a social organizing principle to give to people on an equal basis, which, you know, their basic needs, I mean, is kind of, it's really an unheard of idea. How do you see the sort of empowerment passing to people to ask for that, to bring that about, to see that as a possible goal?
Well, I mean, so Allison, you know, once again, I said that I look at things sort of as an evolutionary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You know, this is also something that I explored in my other book, the 2012 book, Time for mm-hmm. The Return of Quetzalcoatl. So, mm-hmm. you know, in a way, I think that we're in a process as a human collective. I mean, one of the ideas, you know, one of the themes of the new book is that we can really think about humanity as being like a giant planetary organism, you know, mm-hmm. like that is in a symbiotic relationship with the ecology of the Earth continuously as a whole system.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I feel that we're going through like a birthing process, you know, to you know, you could talk about like the noosphere, as some people talk about, like the you know, the sort of collective, you know, brain, the global brain kind of waking up and so on. And, you know, birthing processes have, you know, kind of, you know, a rhythm of contractions and you know, expansions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, something like the Great Society in the 60s were a big expansion, you know, of human mm-hmm. possibility, the civil rights movements. You know, now we're having an intense, very intense contraction, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this contraction is necessary to generate the energy for the next expansion, the next breaking through, maybe the actual, you know, kind of collective birth, you know, of mm-hmm. something better, you know, because we can now see, obviously, you know, we're in unprecedented circumstances in many ways, but in one way is that, you know, we're all connected, you know, like new ideas can escape out into the world and propagate. You know, and unfortunately, some of the ideas that have been propagating right now are bad ideas, but it's mm-hmm. not necessarily going to stay that way. You know.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, that's true because I mean, I have to say, I've had that experience through being online, being in the blogosphere, being on the internet, because, you know, when I began reporting on fracking, nobody knew what it was. They assumed it was safe. I did the first major news story on pipeline. You know, nobody understood what was going on with pipelines. You know, and now everybody knows about it. And so, in a way, it's kind of shocking and dazzling to see many people out, you know, hundreds and thousands of people out there talking and using the same language and descriptions that we put forth, you know, when nobody was listening, you know, and it's not that long ago. It's like 8 years ago or something like that. So there is this tremendous...
You know, it's just, you know, in terms of the ecological movement, the progressive community, you know, mm-hmm. as we discussed a little bit before, there's a huge emphasis on, you know, the fracking of the pipelines, of course. But I think also what's been sort of lacking is like, okay, like, you know, what's the legitimate alternative? I mean, the legitimate alternative is we need to shift to nearly 100% renewable energy, not in like 50 or 70 or 100 years, but in,
right.
like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And then,
right.
then once again, that seems implausible. But actually, there's nothing physical that's stopping us from doing that. I mean, we, you know, we have the capacity to mass manufacture solar panels and wind turbines and batteries. You know, we have the factories that can do that. We have a lot of people on the planet who could be trained to install those and so on. You know, and you know, so the impediment is not our physical capacity. The impediment is our ideologies and our political and economic systems that are obstructing
yes.
us from doing what we need to do, you know.
Right.
And we also know that there are times in the past when, these things have happened, you know, that a complex society has redirected itself, you know, usually because of war. You know, so for instance, the U.S. after Pearl Harbor, you know, redirected its entire manufacturing base to scale up for wartime production and started taxing the wealthiest people in the society at 94%. So they would have the financial capital necessary to make this transition. So that's kind of the circumstance that we're in globally when it comes to the, you know, what's happening ecologically. We would need to have a planet-wide social movement that was aimed at renewable energy, regenerative farming, cradle-to-cradle industry that would you know, require a shift from, you know, very centralized top-down systems of control to decentralized systems based on local participatory democracy that would scale from a local to a bioregional to a planetary framework. And, mm-hmm. and the tools for doing that also exist in terms of the, you know, the internet could easily be used for that. You know, financially, you know, we have to understand that the money that we're currently using is inherently destructive. The money is, is debt-based and creates interest. It automatically creates scarcity. It automatically creates winners and losers. You know, so ultimately, we're going to have to, you know, redesign our system for exchanging value. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the book, I look at different good ideas for how to do that, which include this economist Bernard Lyotard, who was one of the architects for the euro from Belgium, talks about the idea of creating a negative interest trading currency. So, a currency that has like a timestamp. So when you get that currency, the longer you hold on to it, the less it's worth. So you have no incentive then to hoard it. You want to keep circulating it. You want to get it to other people who are trying to do projects or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So you're in the position of investing into things that lead in the right direction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the money then circulates, you know, more like energy in a body or something. Like no cells in the body are able to store and hoard excess amounts of energy and prevent other cells from having without dying. I mean, the body needs to have a very efficient cycling of energy. And if we think of humanity being something like a collective body, you know, we need the same thing. You know, I guess part of what I'm really kind of, you know, putting forth in the book, and I know it's going to be a jump, is, finding a new language, you know, a new set of principles so that we can start sort of have a discussion on a different level. Because I feel that now our discussions, we're very obstructed by the prevailing ideologies. So we can't talk about, you know, politics without talking about, you know, Democrats and the Republicans or Trump and Clinton. You know, we can't talk about energy until we immediately start talking about, you know, fracking and pipelines and so on. Like, I think in a way we need to refocus the dialogue on, you know, what's actually the necessity for our human community to thrive, you know, collectively. And kind of like put more emphasis on, you know, the comprehensive solution path. And also I think like it's also very important for young people. So I think there's something, you know, like I mean, I love Bill McKibben. You know, he's brave and brilliant. And 3fizzy.org is a great movement. But you know, when I read his work, like Earth or something, you know, he it's still very much like, you know, the best we can do is to hold on for a little while to what we've had. I mean, it's not an inspiring vision, and it's certainly not a vision that's going to inspire like young people. So what I suggest in the book, you know, is that we can look at this ecological crisis and then now the geopolitical crisis we're facing as a kind of spiritual adventure, as a kind of an initiation or a mission. And in some ways, it's almost like we're in a movie like Star Wars or The Matrix or something. And it's actually like kind of almost hilarious that, you know, Steve Bannon, Trump's chief advisor, has been, you know, kind of conjuring up like Darth Vader and Satan and saying that he actually identifies with these people, you know, with these figures. But in that way, it's a very archetypal situation. There's like, you know, these archetypes have now been activated in the collective psyche. And so they're, you know, from a Jungian perspective, this is a process that needs to take place. You know, it's a big one. you know, and we as individuals can, you know, step into it, you know, with our courage and our willpower and our intention, and, you know, really try to bring about the world that we know is possible, which is not this world, is something much better.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I belong to a co-op in New York City, a food co-op. It's one of the oldest in the country. And it's really interesting in light of what's going on. And I'm a reporter at the co-op. So we're actually performing the same function of, you know, the free press and kind of keeping the structures honest and transparent and really, you know, going for group decision making and informing the people and enlisting really our members to get involved and interested in the decisions the co-op makes rather than regarding it as a kind of just enhanced cheaper grocery store, you know, with some business that goes on that's kind of none of my concern. And even with that, in fact, it is very much a forefront of my participation in cooperative activities. And, you know, I can see the learning curve, both in terms of valuing something like that as something to devote extra effort to, perhaps, beyond, you know, whatever the defined limits of one's work slot might happen to be, you know, versus not. And it's, you know, so I think we do. I like what you're saying. I think it's incredibly hopeful. I think there's a big learning curve for everybody, and also in interacting, because we've all, I see this at the co-op, we're all used to hierarchical structures. We're all used to sort of reverence for a certain kind of authority system. We're really not used to a participant, you know, people haven't had the opportunity. I think maybe people need to practice that. What are the best ways if somebody wanted, and, you know, I'm in a participant in several, like two major local communities, right? So I've been thinking about that question a lot. You know, how do we learn? How do we redevelop that capacity, which has been sort of neglected in our times while we were going on doing something else that we thought was so important for ourselves as individuals. What ways have you found for people to kind of regrow that ability?
I mean, you know, that's a really great question, and you know, I appreciate your experience there, and I agree with you. I mean, I think people need to get their hands in there and experiment, and it is difficult, and we're not used to it, you know. So I mean, I created a nonprofit called the Evolver Network, and we had a lot of local groups, like 50 or something local chapters, and it was kind of, you know, we were, you know, basically kind of hippie anarchists, but we were mm-hmm. also trying to create a structure, and you know, trying to figure out what would be the easiest structure to support, you know, people for becoming organizers and volunteers. And we hit all those issues, you know, around like centralized authority and people resenting the headquarters and projecting on us and no longer wanting to work
right.
with us or trusting us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, so these are very real, real issues. I mean, one thing that I'm very interested in are, virtual tools for, community decision making. There's one called Lumio, LLOMIO.org, and essentially mm-hmm. they took the Occupy movement's system for decision making, and they turned it into a platform. So you can get on there with your community, and you can vote for, you can put up proposals. You know, do we all want to wear red socks next Monday? And people can mm-hmm. vote, yes, no, abstain, or they can try to block. You know, and as an Occupy, a block means that if you take it so seriously that if the motion goes through, you're leaving the community, So, but what's good about it would be to have it, virtually makes a lot of sense, because I saw with Occupy how the face-to-face got very bogged down and sort mm-hmm. of, crazy people or unhinged
yep.
people or would kind of take over the processes. So mm-hmm. if you could consign a lot of that to the virtual world, then when people met together, maybe they would be more coherent on what they're doing together. you know.
You know, it's interesting what you just what you said, a few points back when we were talking about energy, and you said, you know, we need to focus on renewable energy. And Mark Ruffalo, who comes out of the same neighborhood in opposition to fracking, you know, that I came from, you know, has developed with Mark Jacobson the Solutions Project, which has gone state by state and said how each state could achieve independence in a certain time frame. And recently, Bernie Sanders had just this last week had a conversation with Josh Fox, and in which Bernie was kind of saying to Josh, you know, again, non-hierarchical in a certain sense, he's saying, what are the solutions? What about the Solutions Project, right? So, in that sector, those solutions are there. They've been there. You know, Mark Ruffalo kind of went off to help, you know, that map get drawn rather than, you know, staying at the front lines of every fracking or pipeline site. You know, he kind of developed that area of it, and we do have them. You know, what we don't have, which I think you also sketch in the book, is a way for people, like right now in an oligarchic system, 75% of the people could want this, but then we have this situation where what the people want is not really what's reflected by the political system. You know, how does that whole thing transition? How do you see that shifting?
Well, I mean, you know, the dynamics of system change are obviously, you know, complicated. And I, you know, for me to just say this is how it's going to change, you know, would just be kind of stupid. You know, so, I mean, you know, I think there's, you know, a number of things happen. You know, movements form, crises happen, you know, ideas get propagated about how things could be different, you know, and then ultimately some type of, you know, climactic threshold may occur. You know, an example of that, once again, being, you know, the Berlin Wall in 1989, which was not predicted that was possible, you know. And you know, the problem with that, when the Berlin Wall came down is, you know, the only ideas around were the wrong ideas. And this was intentional in a way. Like, did you read? I'm sure you read like Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. So she talked about the neoliberal economists from the Chicago School, who you know, were conservatives, who like they didn't like what was happening in the 60s. They didn't like the larger middle class and more educated population and more dissenting and, you know, more fighting for civil liberties and, you know, more equalization of wealth. They wanted it to go back in the other direction, but they realized that the time wasn't right for their ideas, so they created a whole set of like academic institutions and think tanks, and you know, created like research papers and magazines. And you know, Milton Friedman, who was the head of that group, even said very explicitly, you know, when a crisis comes, the ideas that get applied are the ones that are lying around. So our role is to be ready to get our ideas out, and then when the crisis comes, we rush in. So they were aware of that. It was strategic. I mean, one really interesting problem with the liberal progressive community is that it's not strategic in the same way that the right wingers are. And it's totally. You know, at that point, it's just turning to be that's suicidal. You know, so like, you know, and you have to say that, you know, Trump was smarter, way smarter than Clinton and how he ran his campaign, because they figured out that, you know, targeted Facebook messages using Cambridge Analytica would be the way to switch the psychology of voters. And they put a huge amount of emphasis into, you know, disseminating fake news, lies, you know, like, you know, they're using the media in a very propagandistic but very skillful way. And, and ultimately, if we're going to, you know, escape this you know, Houdini-like trap that we're now in, you know, we have to start, you know, doing something similar on the other side, you know. But anyway, that's a little bit of a digression. But yeah, the point I was making that, you know, we can guarantee that more crises are coming, big ones. We can guarantee that. So we have a few years, maybe. We can't say exactly how long, to spread as fast as we can and as far as we can a new set of ideas and prototypes, you know, for how things could change. You know, so that's really what's up right now. But we can see, you know, like, you know, the deregulation of the financial system led to the crash of 2008. You know, these guys are going to take all the brakes off of the system. You know, the system is going to crash again. It's going to crash bigger, you know, and then it's going to be like they're going to try to, you know, probably keep it together with wars. You know, I mean, you know, you can see their game plan is, you know, you reduce education, you reduce healthcare, you give the poor people guns, you know, and see what happens, you know, and then you create wars, you know, so you don't have to like, you know, take care of the people. You just send them out to these horrible wars. So, you know, even so, you know, this system is not going to be sustainable, and it's going to crack apart. You know, and so the requirement right now is for people to have a coherent, you know, understanding of what's happening. You know, and I think, you know, my book and a bunch of other books are really helpful for that, like Paul Mason's book and, you know, the post-capitalism and so on. And then begin to experiment with these tools, you know, whether it's community building tools or decision-making tools or alternative currencies or cryptocurrencies, you know, and then, you know, be aware that it's going to reach some crescendo at some point.
Yeah, I think that's a realistic scenario for, you know, what we're heading toward. And, you know, we have to start, this is the adaptation that people have to start, you know, kind of putting their foot into this and that. And I like it, you know, it's really interesting around the time that, you know, the Trump administration began moving its pawn pieces into play and all of that kind of thing, there came up this notion of resisting, you know, resist, and people sent me T-shirts that say resist on them and all of this. And, you know, I just don't think resist. I mean, if you were making an intention or, you know, or a prayer or something like that, it wouldn't be resist. I shall resist. That's not a very, it's not an energized kind of movement to just resist. It's purely reactive. And in that, I agree with you that, you know, the tendencies that we have on the left are not strategic. The thing that that kind of came up in that time frame when I was sort of poised there with that question of this is a sucky term for what we're going to have to do here, was I heard a younger member of the James Taylor family, Isaac Taylor, singing the song Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, Hold On. And there was something about holding on to, which is also, you know, there's a holding together hexagram in the I Ching, the idea of looking at a prize, which is looking at, you know, a better potential for humankind, you know, more caring systems, more actualization of collective caring, you know, that would be the expansion in the terms that you're discussing, as opposed to the contraction where it's like, you know, we'll cut off everything that's sick and weak and dump on everyone and we're all in, you know, it's kind of like the last fatal gasp of this toxic competitive dissociation from other living beings. And it isn't really the best nature of most people or how anyone wants to be, you know, if they had their dream. It's just, you know, kind of the cynical, sad experience of, you know, kind of a certain pathway we've been on. So I think, you know, calling to that better potential that people truly want, you know, and then supplying some, you know, some kind of doable steps and making prototypes. You know, I mean, that may be probably one of the better chances we have in the whole situation. Who have been the idols for you or the people that really have informed your own understanding, you know, like, I don't know, we're coming down to like the last 8 minutes or so of the show, and, you know, the most critical people for people to read and understand that have inspired you? In your book, How Soon Is Now?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about a lot of different, you know, thinkers in the book. I mean, Bugwitz or Fuller is one of the crucial ones. I really really resonate with the books that he wrote in the 60s, like Utopia or Oblivion or Operation Spaceship Earth. And he was, you know, he was a comprehensive systems thinker. And he recognized that one of the problems we had was that people were trained to be specialists. You know, so if you're a scientist, you're studying, you know, some microbe or some, you know, some chromosome, you know, some tiny little, you know, piece of one chromosome.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody's in their little specialist worlds. And,
right.
And therefore, we're not really looking at the big picture. So that was something that really inspired this book, because I felt that even though I didn't really know anything when I started, or very much anyway, about political theory or social theory or agriculture or you know, industry or energy, I was like, okay, like, you know, I can look at all these areas and try to find my balance point, you know, and if I can find it, then I can share it with other people, and we'll begin to, you know, be able to all have a sort of comprehensive and generalist understanding of the situation that we're in. So he was very important to me. Hannah Arendt is a political philosopher. Her book On Revolution is very fascinating. She looked at the history of, you know, revolutions and radical changes. And she noted that often when there's a breakdown in central authority, people just start to self-organize. You know, we saw it recently in Argentina when the financial collapse happened there. The workers cooperatively took over the factories, and the teachers went back to school and took over the schools and so on. So that was very fascinating. Then often in revolutionary times, she noted that the revolutionaries were the one who ended the actual experiment in radical democracy, because they wanted control and hierarchical power systems again.
Mm-hmm. I just want to interject the name of the book again. It's called How Soon Is Now by Daniel Pinchbeck. I want to urge listeners to go out and get the book. It's really important, both because it does provide this systemic view, which is so hard to come by. I remember applying for an advocacy editor position at Huffington when I was writing for them, and when the new young editor who'd come in saw my background in food, health, and the environment, policy, and science, he was like, oh, you're all over the place. he couldn't get his mind around it because it wasn't narrow enough. But you do more. You provide solutions. It's really important for people to both read this book, to share the book, and to get the book out there, because the traditional, just the, you know, the same reductive thinking that you delineate in science and in our ability to see these systemic problems is also true in the publishing world, where, you know, the same solutions are repeatedly marketed to us in books, and that's why, you know, we have to, you know, a book like this won't get on Good Morning America as easily as it should because of those entrenched systems in place, and that's why those of us who care about these things need to read this book, order it, let people know about it, and get it out there, because it is very rare in being, you know, this kind of brilliant systemic overview. Just want to say that. We're coming down to the last minute or two of the show here. Any final words for our listeners, Daniel Pinchbeck?
Well, thank you, Allison, so much for all the nice things you said about the book. Yeah, there's a website for the book, howsoonisnow.info. Mm-hmm. There's also, I started a podcast on iTunes, which is also called How Soon Is Now. And, yeah, I certainly hope people will check it out.
Oh, that'll be great. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, and thank you for this terrific work of, you know, so many years of your life. It's definitely worth it and really helpful and terrific. And, you know, like, hope all goes well with everything that you're up to and doing. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Allison. See you at the cafe soon.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I was going to say the Collective Radio Network. That's interesting. we'll be with you next week. Be well. Chin up. March forward. Get How Soon Is Now, because the time is now. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
And there was night, and there was dark, and there was light. There was the earth, there was the sky, and there in the tree that crawled alive. Um,
Back to God again.
My